Chapter 24. They had a stateroom on the Dun Otter Castle from Port Natal to Cape Town. There were other young people aboard. Anna, in her elegant new clothing and sparkling with excitement, formed the centrepiece of a gay little group that played deck games, dined, danced, and flirted as the mailboat drove south through the sunny golden days of early autumn. At first, Garrick was content to stay unobtrusively close to Anna. He was there to hold her coat, fetch a book, or carry a rug. He watched her fondly, reveling in her success, hardly jealous when she almost disappeared behind a palisade of attentive young men, not resenting the sofa which formed his uncomfortable bed in the drawing-room of their suite. Then, gradually, there came a realization among their travelling companions that Garrick was paying for most of the refreshments and other little expenses that came up each day. They became aware of him, and of the fact that he appeared to be the richest of the group. From there, it needed only a small adjustment to their thinking to admit Garrick to the circle. The men addressed remarks directly at him, and some of the girls flirted with him openly and sent him on small errands. Garrick was at once overjoyed and appalled by these attentions, for he could not cope with the lightning exchange of banter that flickered around him and left him stammering and blushing. Then Garrick found how easy it really was.
"Have a dram, old chap."
"No, really, I don't, you know."
"Nonsense, everybody does. Steward, bring my friend here a whiskey."
"Really, no, really, I won't." And, of course, Garrick did. It tasted foul, and he spilt a little of it on Anna's evening dress. While he wiped it up with his handkerchief, she whispered a barbed reprimand, then laughed gaily at a joke from the moustached gentleman on her right. Garrick shrank miserably back in his chair and forced down the rest of the whisky. Then, slowly and exquisitely, the glow came upon him, starting deep down inside him and spreading out warmly to the very tips of his fingers.
"Have another one, Mr. Courtney?"
"Yes, thanks.
I'll have the same again, but I think it's my round."
He had the next drink. They were sitting in deck chairs on the upper deck in the shelter of the superstructure. There was a moon and the night was warm. Someone was talking about Chelmsford's Zulu campaign.
"You're wrong on that point," Garrick said clearly. There was a small silence.
"I beg your pardon?" The speaker glanced at him with surprise. Garrick leaned forward easily in his chair and began talking. There was a stiffness at first, but he made a witticism and two of the women laughed. Garrick's voice strengthened. He gave a quick and deep-sighted resume of the causes and effects of the war. One of the men asked a question. It was a sharp one, but Garrick saw the essence of it and answered neatly. It was all very clear, and he found the words without effort.
"You must have been there," one of the girls hazarded.
"My husband was at Rorke's Drift," said Anna quietly, looking at him as though he were a stranger.
"Lord Chelmsford has cited him for the award of the Victoria Cross. We're waiting to hear from London."
The party was silent again, but with new respect.
"I think it's my round, Mr. Courtney. Yours is whisky, isn't it?"
"Thank you." The dry, musty taste of the whisky was less offensive this time. He sipped it thoughtfully and found there was a faint sweetness in the dry. As they went down to their staterooms later that night, Garrick put his arm around Anna's waist.
"What fun you were tonight," she said.
"Only a reflection of your charm, my darling.
I am your mirror."
He kissed her cheek, and she pulled away, but not violently.
"You're a tease, Gary Courtney."
Garrick slept on his back on the sofa, with a smile on his face, and no dreams. But in the morning his skin felt tight and dry, and there was a small ache behind his eyes. He went through to the bathroom and cleaned his teeth. It helped a little, but the ache behind his eyes was still there. He went back to the drawing room and rang for the cabin steward.
"Good morning, sir."
"Can you bring me a whiskey and soda?" Gary asked hesitantly.
"Certainly, sir."
Gary didn't put the soda into it, but drank it neat, like medicine. Then, afterwards, miraculously, the glow was there again, warming him. He had hardly dared to hope for it. He went through to Anna's cabin. She was rosy with sleep, her hair a joyous tangle on the pillow.
"Good morning, my darling."
Garrick stooped over her and kissed her, and his hand moved to cover one of her breasts through the silk of her gown.
"Gary, you naughty boy!"
She slapped his wrist, but jokingly. There was another honeymoon couple aboard, returning to their farm near Cape Town, 75 acres of the finest vines on the whole of the Cape Peninsula, the man's own words. Anna and Garrick were forced by sheer persistence to accept their invitation to stay with them. Peter and Jane Hugo were a delightful pair, very much in love, rich enough, popular, and in demand with Cape Town society. With them, Anna and Garrick spent an enchanted 6 weeks. They went racing at Milnertown. They swam at Musenberg in the warm Indian Ocean. They picnicked at Clifton and ate crayfish, fresh caught and grilled over open coals. They rode to hounds with the Cape Hunt and caught 2 jackals after a wild day's riding over the Hottentots, Holland. They dined at the fort, and Anna danced with the governor. They went shopping in the bazaars that were filled with treasures and curiosities from India and the Orient. Whatever Anna wanted, she was given. Gary bought himself something as well, a silver flask, beautifully worked and set with cornelians. It fitted into the inside pocket of his coat, without showing a bulge. With its help, Garrick was able to keep pace with the rest of the company. Then the time came for them to leave. The last night there were only the 4 of them for dinner, and it was sad with the regret of present parting, but happy with the memory of shared laughter. Jane Hugo cried a little when she kissed Anna good night. Gary and Peter lingered on downstairs until the bottle was finished. And then they walked upstairs together and shook hands outside Gary's bedroom. Peter spoke gruffly.
"Sorry to see you 2 go. We got used to having you around. I'll wake you early and we can go out for a last early morning ride before the boat leaves."
Gary changed quietly in the bathroom and went through to the bedroom. His peg made no sound on the heavily carpeted floor. He crossed to his own bed and sat down to unstrap his peg.
"Gary?"
Anna whispered.
"Hello. I thought you were asleep."
There was a stirring, and Anna's hand came out from under the bedclothes, held towards him in invitation.
"I was waiting to say good night to you."
Gary crossed to her bed, suddenly awkward again.
"Sit down for a minute," said Anna,
and he perched on the edge of her bed.
"Gary, you don't know how much I've enjoyed these last weeks. They've been the happiest days of my whole life. Thank you so much, my husband."
She reached up and touched his cheek. She looked small and warm, curled up in the bed.
"Kiss me good night, Gary."
He leaned forward to touch her forehead with his lips, but she moved quickly and took it full on her mouth.
"You can come in if you like," she whispered, her mouth still against his.
She opened the bedclothes with one hand. So Gary came to her when the bed was warm and the wine still sang a little in her head, and she was ready, in the peculiar passion of early pregnancy. It should have been so wonderfully good. Impatient now, ready to lead him, she reached down to touch, and then stilled into surprise, disbelief. Where there should have been hardness, male and arrogant, there was slackness and uncertainty. Anna started to laugh. Not even the shotgun blast had hurt as deeply as that laugh.
"Get out," she said through the cruel laughter. "Go to your own bed."